Doug Vernier is president of VSoft Communications and senior consulting engineer at Doug Vernier Telecommunications Consultants. He served 7 years as the principal consulting engineer for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's digital radio conversion program, and also has been the director of broadcast services at the University of Northern Iowa. Please welcome Doug Vernier.
Well, thank you very much. Anybody want to stand up for a minute or so? I'd be happy to give you a minute of my presentation to stretch your feet a little bit. I know that we all had a nice lunch and we walked around a lot, but it's important to get the blood flowing. So we'll start off here. I'm going to try to cover some topics which relate to the status of AM, FM, and a little bit of TV. And at the same time, we'll talk about the perspective of interference and how it's affecting our services, our broadcast services. And obviously, from this slide, you can see that AM, and as you all, I think, know, is in quite a bit of trouble. Low or little profitability, very little resale value, few listeners. Aging infrastructure, ground conductivity or ground radials dying, have been dying and are still almost gone. We have radios that have narrow IFs to avoid interference, and many stations are going dark. And of course, the last one you've heard about, BMW, not putting AM in its electric models. So here's some of the things that, as most of you know, cause interference to AM. All of these here, dimmer switches, overhead power lines, and LED lights, fluorescent ballasts, computers and televisions with plasma screens. We have one that really tears up our radios and TV and my ham radio as well. Motors, switches, car ignitions. Lightning is an issue, but as you recall, electronic filters, I don't know, heating pads, things, a lot of lists, part of this list is not there, but electric blankets, all of these affecting the noise level for AM radio makes it difficult, and some people don't like to listen to it because of that. Here's an issue that we have with IBOC on AM, and hopefully IBOC will be part of the savings grace of AM in the future when we can convert it to all digital. But the issue you have is with interference. And the fact is that for directional arrays, you have a pattern bandwidth issue, and that is that the adjacent frequencies don't have the same pattern. The dark line is 1,000 kilohertz, and the other lines are the first adjacent channels on either side. Well, one of them looks pretty good at 990, and the other one at 1010, that's the one that stretches way down to the bottom, looks totally off. Now, if you had a station that was down there on the first adjacent channel, it would be caused interference. And this is a real serious issue, particularly for nighttime coverage. Half of the stations, the AM stations that started running IBOC, have now stopped for a number of reasons. But interference was one of the large issues. So we have some proposals that are floating around to fix AM. You've probably heard some of these already. We talked in this particular seminar about the digital modulation, all digital, and reinventing AM with, you can use current IBOC radios to pick it up, but there's not many of those out there. It's going to take years for that to happen. And then, of course, there'll be a long transition period if you ever expect profitability. There's a proposal to modify the AM efficiency standards downward so you don't have to have as efficient antenna. You can have smaller antennas. You can move them around. It's very flexible, but you can't transmit as far. And you don't have the efficiency. So does that help AM? No, it doesn't help AM. It causes more interference because you're not as loud as you used to be. How about reducing the day and nighttime community coverage standards? This has been proposed. Well, it would certainly help some stations that want to move around. They wouldn't have to cover the daytime. The daytime coverage wouldn't have to cover the city of license. But what happens is you don't have the signal over the city that you need for good interference-clear reception. Eliminating the ratchet rule is another proposal. The ratchet rule went into effect 15, 20 years ago because at that time there was great concern about AM, as there is today. And that concern was that there's too much interference, station to station, nighttime interference. So how can we stop this? Well, the ratchet rule was imposed by the FCC. And what you had to do is if you made a change, a minor change in your facilities, you had to reduce your contribution to the RSS, to the root sum square of all of the stations that you're an interference, that you're part of the interference combination. So that would reduce your interference that you would cause, and eventually the idea was that it would clear up the band. Well, stations didn't like that. It's very difficult now for stations to want to improve because if they do, they have to reduce their RSS contribution at night by 10%. Well, we could open a window for FM translators for AM stations. Of course, there's an issue about this. There's not enough frequencies to go around. And secondly, does this help AM? No, it forces people over to FM. And so I'm not sure that's an answer either. We can mandate receiver improvement. Well, I think that would work pretty well. But how are you going to do that? The FCC is loath to do this kind of a thing. Broader banded receivers, wider modulation for stations instead of this narrow modulation that so many manufacturers have put into their automobile radios because of the interference that this was occurring to their AM service. Then there's the modulation-dependent carrier proposals, which are good for AM in that they cut the power down by 50% in silent passages. It's much more efficient for transmitters. But it doesn't really do much as far as the interference situation. Let's go over to FM now. What's going on over at FM? Well, we've got a freeze on applications for all applications right now for any major changes for commercial, NCE, non-commercial educational, and translator stations. The LPFM application window has been opened and closed. And right now, they're making mutual exclusive settlements, which are minor changes are allowed. You can change more than two channels up or down. The commission's going to allow that for negotiations that would allow LPFM stations or more LPFM stations to exist. You can still put out an allocation petition for a new FM station. The problem with that is that if the FCC accepts your proposal for a drop-in, that it goes to auction, and you can bid on it, but it's going to cost you perhaps some big bucks, particularly if you have a good allocation. There's not too many of those left. We've heard about General Motors removing IBOC from several models. That's an issue, a real problem for us. There's a lack of the adoption of IBOC outside of the major cities. So it's just too costly for them, and there's not enough radios out there, and their competition, they feel, doesn't do it, so we don't think we need to do it. And on FM, of course, it's a lot better than AM. As you well know, lightning, you hardly hear it. It's not affected by impulse noise the way AM is. We can thank Major Armstrong for that contribution. Long story about poor Major Armstrong, but he finally jumped out of a tall building, to make a long story short. The environmental noise is still an issue. You've got routers, particularly computer routers. Switching power supplies are notorious. LED lights are causing problems, cable leakage. You've got issues now from all of the new LPFM stations. There's 1,222 of those LPFM CPs that were granted some 3 or 4 months ago, and there's been more since then, and now the negotiations going on for those that were MX'd. And they're taking up a spectrum, and I'll be talking about the impact that they have on CoChannel in just a moment. There are weaknesses in the FCC's contour prediction method, which cause some issues with regard to interference, particularly in rugged terrain. And then there's the short space stations, and plenty of them on the east side of the Mississippi, and you have problems with IBOC. I have a client that was short spaced, and the other station was running pretty heavy IBOC, and so they were asking me, should I run IBOC to interfere with them because we'll get them back? And you know, that's not the answer, but that's something that hasn't been provided for very well. The other problem about IBOC is that, you know, the interference, if it occurs on your radio and you're a listener, I mean, you don't know that it's IBOC because it's digital. And your radio gets fuzzed up. You don't have as much coverage as you used to be. So it's hard to really know. And Ubiquiti says, well, we don't have any complaints. Well, who knows what it is when they listen. So we have another issue with interference, or the issue of signal-to-noise ratio when it relates to running IBOC. And there was a study that was done by Dave Hirschberg of Continental Electronics, and where he looked at the signal-to-noise ratio with varying IBOC injection levels. And I don't know if you can read that from there, but the first line under digital power is 1%. That's a minus 20 dBc. That's exactly what everybody started out with in this business when IBOC was authorized at the FCC. And the composite signal-to-noise without an IF filter was 50 dB, with an IF filter, 54.1 dB. Then if you were running 4% IBOC, which is the new standard, minus 14 dBc, your signal-to-noise would drop down to 42.8 dB. And with a filter, a good filter in the IBOC, you could have a 48.4 dB signal-to-noise. With a minus 10, the signal-to-noise drops down to 36.9 dB. And, of course, you can run minus 10 if you don't cause interference. It's a specialty. You have to apply specialty for that right at the FCC. That's from Radio World, by the way, this table. We also have an issue with side-mounted FM antennas. The FCC calls these omnidirectional when they are omnidirectional, when they're not specifically directional. But there isn't really any antenna anywhere when you put them on a side of a tower that's going to be omnidirectional. Here is an example. The red line is the horizontal azimuth pattern. The black is the vertical. This is relative field that we're looking at. And here is a station. You look at the bay there on the tower. The tower is the triangular. Tower is right here, and we have a stiff arm over here on this side, and we have the bay here. So you can see what that does to the pattern when it's mounted that way. And let's move it now where the bay is due north on the leg of the tower. Stiff arm runs quite far back, and you get a pretty good combination of the horizontal and the vertical pattern to the north, which is probably a good way to put this. But as you continue to move around, you can see that the pattern changes considerably as you move the antenna in its azimuth. Here's a side mount antenna on the side of the tower, not the leg, and the pattern is completely pushed in on the horizontal. And as we go along and move that antenna, we can see how this changes with the location of the antenna. and it's mount bracketing on the tower. And that's the way they make a directional antenna. They just field test this, and they look at the tower, and they look at the bracketing, and they move the antenna around until they get the pattern. A lot easier than AM. So that's an issue that we have to think about, because there are places where you have a 3 dB gain if you side mount it on a tower, and a 3 dB loss in the other direction. Well, 3 dB is twice the power. So you could actually be running twice the power in the direction of a given station, and the contours are based upon it that you're operating at standard power, which is 3 dB down. Interference. And there's no way to quantify that other than to say, if you do put an antenna side of a tower, do a pattern study and do an optimization, at least you know where it's going. So then let's talk about the advent of LPFM. And basically the same story goes with translators too. On this map, this is a Longley Rice map produced by our probe program. And it's showing the 50 dBU, that's in yellow, of the station KREF. And all of that red is based on a U to D ratio that comes from various studies, the NRSC DAB studies and the NPR labs studies to determine the interference ratios. And we've adopted those, and we've done some tweaking on those, and we use those in our program. This is a co-channel situation. So the LPFM is transmitting on the same frequency, and all of those little red blobs there are interference areas. All right, they're beyond the 50 dBU, and typically a Class A or C station is protected only to the 60 dBU. So, you know, this is okay as far as the FCC is concerned, no problem at all. But you could take a car and drive it out to the 34 dBU and still get pretty good reception. The car radio will blend, and you get good reception, but not with that LPFM station out there on the same channel. So, I mean, there's no free lunch. You give up something for what you get. You get a new LPFM station, and you lose the distant coverage. So I was talking a little bit about the FCC prediction method there. It's an old method, and it looks at terrain from 2 to 10 miles. So it doesn't really care about the first 0 to 2 from the transmitter or the antenna. It looks at 54 points. That's really not a lot of data points, and that's because that method comes from the days when we had topographic maps. And they weren't. The resolution wasn't that great, and your eye wasn't that great when you looked up the radials. And the FCC didn't think you had to go further than having 54 points. Well, the new digital method. Of course, we've digitized all the curves that the FCC came up with this method. Still uses 54 points at the commission. I mean, it could use many more than that in interpolating the values of the terrain. But this system can't see a mountain past the 10-mile point. So you could actually have a mountain, but the coverage itself will show that you have coverage on the other side of the mountain all over. So you have some issues with that. And as I mentioned, this method is based on curves, standard curves, and done by actual measurements. And we find that there's significant inaccuracies when the terrain varies widely from what the curves, original curves, from the areas where they were measured. If you're in Florida and you're a commercial station, let's say you have two Class A's, they have to be, oh, I can't remember now exactly, 36 kilometers apart. No, it's more than that, but anyway. What basically that was set up to be, the standard minimum separations, was the interference contour goes this far and the protected contour, 60 dBU, goes this far. And that total distance becomes the minimum separation that you have to be away from the station. And that works pretty well, usually, in Florida. But if you go into areas that are hilly, then you have some situations where you might have an HAT with one radio that's really, really high, but it's put in the average, so it gets pushed down, and that radial is a direct line of sight to another station. You got interference. So we actually have another method, the Longley-Rice method, P.L. Rice and A.G. Longley. That's actually Anita Longley. When they were working for the National Bureau of Standards, they did a lot of actual measurements as well, and came up with a very good method that considers things like atmospheric absorption and rain attenuation, the terrain roughness we're talking about. Longley-Rice actually goes from the transmitter site all the way out to the listener's point. So if it's beyond 10 miles, it's going to go all the way out. It's going to go out to, if you want to be 60 miles away, it's going to go out that far and look at terrain and factor that in. And you have some other issues or factoring of knife edging and forward scatter and long-term fading. The Longley-Rice method, as you know, was used for all the DTV assignments that occurred at the end of the last decade. It turned out to work pretty well, although there's some issues with Longley-Rice, but it's a lot better than the FCC methodology. Well, here's another issue of interference, the IBOC host interference issue. What is that all about? Well, now we can go up to a minus 10 dBc. So if you've got 100 kilowatts, you can run 10 kilowatts if you get permission and you don't have real close first adjacents. You can run 10 kilowatts of IBOC power. So what's the easiest way to do this? Well, existing transmitters don't do it very well at all because they were never prepared for this. They were prepared for the minus 20 dBc. Combiners are terribly inefficient to combine two transmitters into one antenna. So the easiest way would be put a separate antenna up there in the tower and use your backup transmitter or something to and put an IBOC exciter in it. And there you are. You're on the air with IBOC. You can run 10 kilowatts, and you don't have to pay a lot for it. The problem with that, and we'll go to the next slide here. Here's a station that did that, KNOW in Minneapolis. Put on its IBOC at a minus 20 dBc, and it got calls from all those X spots of complaints. They couldn't hear the analog anymore. The analog was being caused interference. Why? Well, you have to look at the vertical elevation field of those antennas. And they actually put up a graph of a 10-bay antenna in black and the IBOC antenna is a 1-bay. And you can see that there's a lot of nulls, and they're close in with the 10-bay. But the 1-bay antenna, in this case it was running 1 kilowatt, doesn't have any nulls. So in the areas where you have, this is, of course, IBOC is first adjacent. It's a minus 6 dB U to D ratio. In the areas where you have the deep nulls, you have IBOC, which is way up above the value of 6 dB. So you end up with interference in those areas. And we plotted out where those interference areas are. And the graph down below shows in red where you exceed minus 6 dB U to D ratio. And that the numbers on there represent the numbers on the map that I just showed you where the calls came in. So they line up pretty well. Here's a situation where we have a 4-bay antenna and a 10-bay primary, a 4-bay IBOC antenna. And the ring there, the two rings, are interference areas. The second ring is fairly large. Some of them are very deep, and I've got them scaled. The green ones are the deeper ones. Here's when you run a minus 10 dBc. Holy Toledo. I mean, you just really light up the area around your transmitter out to 4 kilometers or so with host interference. Your analog gets pretty well creamed. So it's really not a good idea to do this on the same tower. In the same antenna, it's a lot better idea. All right, so here we're going to talk a little bit about Longley Rice and its application, implementation for showing IBOC interference. And this is a slide which shows a station at a minus 10 dBc, and this is WQEI-FM down in the lower left-hand corner, and it's transmitting IBOC, and KVMR is the station up in the hills there transmitting IBOC. And you can see the graph there from down below to up above. It's a direct line of sight. So there's a good line of sight from KQEI on up to KVMR. And what you're looking at with the blue dots are the interference ratio areas where you have interference. There's 21% of this station's audience, it's not a large station, has interference, 32,000 people at a minus 20 dBc or 1% IBOC. Well, here's minus 14 dBc, and you have a jump to 44,821 people receiving IBOC interference. The red line is the 60 dBu, the normally protected line. That's the contour line. And so, you know, you really added quite a bit of interference. And here's a minus 10 dBc, and you've gone up to 32.7%, almost a third of the station's audience having interference from the first adjacent IBOC. Now we can go the other way. Well, actually, this is the path from KVMR down to KQEI. The interesting thing about this particular path is, let me point out what the colors are. The red is the terrain profile, the red, and the line of sight is the green, and underneath that is the Fresnel zone. You can see it hits a peak here. And then the blue is the actual signal value. On the X and the Y scale, you have the elevation, and then on the X scale, you have the distance. And you can see that any time that you're coming down the hill from the station that's receiving this interference, when it gets behind one of these little hills like this one, the signal level drops down considerably. Well, you would expect that. But what also happens is that the signal from the other station is going to be higher because it has a direct line of sight. So that's why we get interference that comes and goes as you drive down the mountain. Here's another example of interference to WRNI from WKLB. KLB up there on the top of the graph. And KLB is a class, let me see, what is, it is a class B station running 14 kilowatts from elevation of 47 meters, and it's got a pretty good antenna height. I don't have that on there. WRNI is a class A, and it's really kind of a small class A. And it's running 1.95 kilowatts and it's short-spaced. And you can see the interference coming in. This is at a minus 20 dBc, and WRNI has complained a long time about this interference, and there's really not much they can do about that. 14.2% of their coverage, and jumping quickly to a minus 10 dBc, and you can see the significantly larger areas, and the interference goes up to 18.7% of their primary coverage in the 60 dBu. Here's the path, and this is actually from WRNI in the direction of WKLB, but only to the 60 dBu of WRNI. So you can see we got a big hill here. And what happens is that listeners to WRNI are down in the lower area here, and this is a water area. And then across that, you can see what happens is that the signal coming from the other direction has a clear view of that area. And that's where you get this IBOC interference. Another quick example, this is a mobile analysis, again using a combination between NPR Labs and the NRSC DAB Committee, using their U-to-D ratios. The 60 dBU of WRUR in this case has caused significant interference. It used to be that you could drive from WRUR FM all the way over here to WBFO, and you get about halfway there, and you'd have to change the channel because they're first adjacent, and you could listen to both stations just by changing the channel. Well, that's not the way it is today. This is a no man's land because both of these stations are running IBOC, so basically you don't have much coverage here. You have all interference. And so here we're looking at a minus 20 dBc, and here's a minus 10. And we go up to 9.4% interference. Let's go the other way. WBFO's interference caused by WRUR FM at minus 20 dBc with a receiver height, by the way, for mobile of 2 meters. You have 0.87, and then at a minus 10 dBc, you've got 2.5% interference. Not a lot of interference comparatively because it's a Buffalo area, so it's a very highly populated area. Here's a case where a translator has gotten wiped out because of IBOC. The translator from picking up KUNI was translating into this community here in the Quad Cities, Davenport area, Rock Island. And once that KNSB went on the air on its first adjacent channel of KUNI, it caused this amount of interference. So it basically wiped out the ability for the translator to pick up KUNI on 90.9 because it's first adjacent. So luckily, the station that went on the air was one of KUNI stations, and so they're able to pick it up directly from that, luckily. That doesn't happen very often. Well, I'm not going to cover the TV band in great detail, only to tell you there are a few things, because we've just talked about repacking, but, you know, I cry a tear every time I look at this, but, you know, remember we used to have 2 through 13, 14 through 51, 52 through 69. Anybody remember when we had up to 81? Yeah, you bunch of old guys in there, too. Well, I remember. Somebody remember Channel 1 here? You do? Okay, well, that was pre-war, so you were a little kid. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, after repacking, how many channels? We don't know, but it could be 2 to 30. And so anyway, right now on TV, if you have a TV station and you want to move, you've got an issue. Minor changes are allowed. However, you cannot increase your coverage service contour, the noise-limited contour, by any at all, any distance at all, any new population. So if you're moving 4 kilometers, I have a client that's moving 4, and he's losing a lot of population to the south. He's moving to the north. He's getting very little population up to the north, but he has to pull that all back because he can't extend his coverage unless we can figure out how the commission will grant a waiver. So that's kind of an issue. And we've already talked about there's no protection for LPTVs that are not Class A's, and TV translators are not protected. So what about noise problems with TV? The environmental noise problem is strong with digital television. As you well know, you know, as you get across the digital divide, you get a black picture. But if you get somewhere in between, you get pixelation. And there are many stations out there that have listeners, or viewers, I should say, that are terrain hampered to a degree. And so they're in situations where they're seeing this pixelation. So the other issue is that many stations decided to stay on their old channel and not to go to the UHF channels. And they had the choice. I know some. I told some of them not to do what they wanted to do. Oh, Channel 2 is great. You know, we're going to stay on Channel 2. All right. So they did, and I've actually put out some waivers for, we've been able to get some help for a station that stayed on Channel 11. The problem is that the lower channels are lousy with DTV. Why? Well, it's been pointed out that in order for the signal to get into a house, you got to get through the windows, and the wavelength of the lower channels are just too big to get in, and they don't knock, so they won't be let in, where UHF is a very small wavelength, and they can go right through. There are terrain issues as well. Then there's the issues we just touched on the last, Kelly Williams' presentation about telco interference. Cellular, the repacking issue is going to be putting telco pretty close to our stations and vice versa. They just come out with a notification, the commission did, that we've done all of the testing. And really, the DTV protection looks about the same for protecting the telcos. So they don't seem to be worried about this, but a lot of DTV operators are. And then you have the usual situation with co-channel and the funny days where you have, particularly the higher UHFs, you have a tremendous skip coming in, coming off of meteors or wherever it's coming from. We talked about this in the last presentation, so I won't talk about it, other than to say that one of the choices in the incentive auction is to move to a VHF channel. Basically to downgrade your facilities. You can move from a possible high VHF to a low VHF, which again is not really going to help propagation. So the question is, what can we do about all of this? Well, I'm not sure I really have any answers here other than there's some things we can think about, and you can probably come up with a few yourself. We need to certainly support AM revitalization, but we need to make sure that no interference is caused with these proposals and with the changes that we make. And I'm not sure there's any proposals that I know of that don't have implications with regard to more interference. And we can petition the FCC to do a better job of regulating environmental interference. We can perhaps use some more DSP noise filtering and receivers with some mandates. Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen, but FM band is crowded enough. Do we need a new class? Remember the class C4 that's been proposed? Do we need another one to squeeze in there? Do we really need minus 10 dBc IBOC? When I drove out of Iowa, I listened to KUNI, a station I used to be working for. It was funny. The IBOC, the HD, dropped out exactly where the 60 dBu drops out. You have a tall tower. That may not be the same for some of the smaller towers. But do we really need a minus 10 dBc, particularly with all the interference that it's going to be causing, or it is causing? Fortunately, it's expensive, and not too many stations have gone to do that, but a number of the bigger groups have. We can keep DTV in the UHF spectrum. I don't think that's going to happen either. And the last question here is about the telecoms. Do they really, really need 120 megahertz? And that's what we're supposed to be getting out of this amazing repacking that the FCC is doing. So, time for questions and maybe some answers if you've got some. Yes, sir. Microphone, please. Okay, we've got another one over here too when you're done. Go ahead.
All right, a couple of things. First of all, I'm a 10-year veteran of the HD radio wars, and I've been through it all. I'm here to assert that The implementation of HD radio has not gone fast enough that this problem of overcrowding by translators could be greatly alleviated if you simply move them the FM signals from AM signals that want to go to translators over to HD radio. They'll get better coverage on many of the FM stations that pair with them. I think the FCC should relax its rules about allowing HD channels to be utilized by program material that is not owned by you. For instance, in Cleveland, WCLV on 104.9 has been able to get full market coverage by going on to the HD2 channel of one of the NPR full power stations in Cleveland, and is doing very well. I don't believe that translators are the answer. I do believe that putting HD2s, 3s, and 4s on out of existing AM signals might alleviate some of the crowding there. In Chicago, WMBI puts its nighttime AM programming on their HD3. There are better ways to do this, and HD radio has more answers than it has problems. And as far as interference of adjacent channel interference, I would only suggest that as a now retired member of Crawford Broadcasting Company's engineering department, we have been in the forefront of HD, including moving our sidebands, minimizing adjacent channel interference or second channel interference by reducing our HD carrier level on the one side. And in California, with the new KBRT setup, they eliminated the upper sideband HD altogether and had no problem with HD reception.
They had to get a waiver to do that.
Yes, they got a waiver to do it, but didn't it solve a problem now?
Yeah, they have to get a waiver for asymmetrical, and you also have to get a waiver.
Yes, you do, but the thing is, if it's going to eliminate the kind of interference that you pointed out up here, then why not?
Yeah, certainly. That'll help.
A couple of comments. Years ago, all the public service people, power companies, had people that went out and looked for bad insulators. They don't have those people anymore. And I think a lot of the AM interference we see today is due to bad insulators and power lines because they just don't care about it anymore.
Yes, you're right.
They just let them leak.
Right.
Second comment about the 120 megahertz of bandwidth for the cellular carriers. They almost right now in this area, in a lot of areas, have excess capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Very few areas really need more capacity in the cellular industry. So I don't know where they're coming from. The other thing is, when you start reallocating channels and putting these high-powered U's in the cellular area, they're going to interfere with the cellular people, not the opposite way. And I don't know if anybody's taken that into account. And now that I understand that they're going to open up channels 2 through 6 for DTV now, is that what you were saying?
Well, the repacking, you'll have the choice to do that if you didn't want to move, if you didn't want to sell your station. They might not be able to find any channel other than the low Vs for you. And if so, you have the choice of going to back to channel 3 or 2 or whatever, mm-hmm. and getting paid for that move, 80%, or going off the air.
That whole repack is just a bureaucratic nightmare. Sorry about that comment.
Okay. Any more questions? Comments? All right. Well, thank you very much.